And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, July 20th. I'd like to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, all the information you need to take action. Let's start with announcements. The Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project needs summer volunteers in this story from the Earth First Update. The Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project needs volunteers for this year's field season in August and through late September. Experienced volunteers are especially desired, but anyone with a passion to learn about and defend the forest is welcome to come. During this time, we will be checking two sales in the Malheur National Forest and will likely be performing more field checking than usual. Logging in the Malheur National Forest threatens many species, including red band steelhead and west slope cutthroat trout. It will eliminate suitable habitat for pileated and three-toed woodpeckers as well as marten. Logging and bioherbicide spraying damages wildlife habitat in roadless areas and in previously unlogged areas. It also puts further stress on areas struggling to recover from past logging and the negative effects of climate change, such as increased insect populations. The Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project has been protecting national forests in eastern Oregon for over 20 years, defending biodiversity and ecological integrity. Over its time, Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project has prevented tens of thousands of acres of logging, protected roadless areas, halted herbicide and biocide spraying, set substantial legal precedent, and paved the way for other radical above-ground groups. It also helped set the 21-inch diameter at breast height limit, which prevents logging of live old-growth trees, and trained at least 200 volunteers. Volunteers can expect to work most of the day investigating areas proposed for logging. You will learn about the effects of proposed logging map and compass orientation, plant, animal, and wildlife identification, and other forest skills. No experience is necessary, but volunteers are preferred who will stay out for two or more consecutive weeks. Meals are cooked communally, but volunteers must contribute to meal costs or bring enough food to contribute for their length of stay. Please bring sufficient gear for camping and hiking. The forest is often quite hot during the day this time of year, but can be very cold at night. If you have a camera, compass, or binoculars, bring these as well. If you can bring a car or truck, please do so. To volunteer, please contact the Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project. Area code 541-385-9167. That number again, 541-385-9167. Or you might send email to paula.e.hood@gmail.com. That's paula.e.hood@gmail.com. Or you may contact her at 510-715-6238. That number again, 510-715-6238. And please contact the Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project at least 2 weeks before you plan to come out. And protesters have blocked the Redwood Company logging trucks at the mill site. In this story from Mendocino Forest Defenders, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Calling for an end to Mendocino Redwood Company's dead-end logging practice, 25 protesters held signs and used large banners to blockade both entrances to MRC's logging deck in Ukiah, California on Wednesday, July 20th. Six logging trucks stacked with redwood poles were stopped for over an hour. Protesters are demanding an end to hack and squirt, a practice which MRC continues to use in the face of Measure 5's overwhelming voter mandate, maybe that's Measure V, in Mendocino County. MRC company officials met protesters at the second gate blockade and made statements defending the herbicide practice, ignoring the will of the people. The issue stems from the application of toxic herbicides on forests, killing the so-called non-marketable hardwoods that are then left standing in place. Supervisors certified Measure V on July 12, just prior to the elapse of the required 30-day waiting period following the publishing of the official tally, thus clearing the way for the measure to become law on July 22. While Measure V focuses solely on the fire dangers posed by millions of dead standing trees in the fifth year of California's drought, many people are equally concerned about the health and safety issues of herbicides themselves. However, local authority to regulate herbicides was usurped in the early 1990s by the state of California after a ballot initiative banning aerial spraying passed by Mendocino County voters was overturned by the legislature. Public opinion finally forced the cessation of the practice. Speakers at the protest underscored the severe health hazards of herbicide use in the environment, as well as the workers and residents from chemicals such as imazpyr, glyphosate, which is brand named Roundup, and triclopyr or Garlon. Polly Gervin, legal aid to the Coyote Valley Band of Pomo Indians, documented the devastating health effects on Latino workers who are among the most vulnerable to exploitation and who often suffer from chemical contamination associated with birth defects, which have been found to occur with higher frequency than in other populations. Those workers also have little recourse against wage theft and other labor violations. Linda Perkins and Bill Heel addressed threats posed to the watershed by poisonous herbicides. The two well-known forest activists from Albion have long questioned Mendocino Redwood Company's right to retain its profitable certified sustainable label despite using herbicides. MRC makes money by using poisons instead of cutting down and removing the trees. The company claims manual removal would cost too much, said Perkins. Regardless of how they are killed, environmentalists oppose the wholesale decimation of the tan oaks, she emphasized, describing them as nurse trees playing an important role in protecting the soil and encouraging biodiversity, which creates a healthier forest rather than monocropping redwoods like tree farms. Bob Simpson, former CEO of MRC's predecessor, Louisiana Pacific, recently stunned the public with his pro-Measure V statements before the vote, claiming tan oaks are the most important trees in the forest and decrying their mass annihilation. MRC had said they would phase out poisons, but instead they are actually applying more concentrated chemicals over a wider area. MRC, while not the sole timber company operating in Mendocino County, is the most egregious user of herbicides based on acreage, dousing thousands of acres of forest lands in 2016 alone. Residents urged the supervisors to be proactive in enforcing Measure V and holding the company accountable for exacerbating the fire danger while continuing to create more dead standing trees in the face of a clear voter mandate to stop. They also demand resolution for full disclosure to ensure that herbicide users notify the public before application. Currently, the contractor is only required to report information after herbicides have already been applied. The message was carried from the county seat directly to Mendocino Redwood Company at its mill site on North State Street, where a protest was held under the banner of Let Our Forests Heal. Activists called on MRC to stop poisoning Mendocino forests and workers and to adopt restorative forest practices. MRC masquerades as a sustainable business, but it's just an image, not the reality, said longtime lay forestry expert Bill Heel. Their brand of greenwash is hogwash. And this story was written by the Coyote Band of Pomo Indians, Save Our Little Lake Valley, Earth First, the Bay Area Coalition for Headwaters, Mendocino Environmental Center, and the Mendocino Forest Defenders. And Oregon wolves, now and in the future. This time of year, Oregon's wolf pups are venturing from their dens to explore their world. It's something worth celebrating. Only 10 years ago, Oregon had just improved a wolf plan in anticipation of the future return of wolves. It's a good time to reflect on the world these pups live in, and the kind of world their pups might live in. At the end of 2015, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife confirmed at least 110 wolves in the state. There are now firmly established families in western Oregon and even northern California. But that number dropped by 4 when the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife killed OR4 and the Imnaha pack. Will the positive trend continue, or will killing wolves become the norm? Last year, ODFW made the controversial decision to strip wolves of their protections as an endangered species. Along the way, they ignored thousands of public comments, dozens of scientists, and a couple of laws. Conservation groups took the agency to court. Rather than argue the merits of the case, politicians cut backroom deals and passed legislation, such as HB 4040, to declare a state of emergency and bar the courthouse doors. Despite the potentially unconstitutional law, a judge ruled the case could proceed. It's not a victory, but it means Wolves and the public will get their day in court. In the end, will science or politics prevail? Proponents of HB 4040 agreed their bill passed on behavior that was not above the board. In response, Cascadia Wildlands filed an ethics complaint. Without commenting on the merits, the complaint was dismissed. It turns out that laws that prohibit lying in Salem don't apply to legislators unless other legislators file the charges. Meanwhile, Governor Kate Brown of Oregon has provided no leadership on wolf issues. Despite her public denial, documents obtained by Oregon Wild reveal that her staff was instrumental in passing the bill. Upon signing HB 4040, Brown made promises that her agency would embark upon an open and transparent collaborative process to ensure continued wolf protections. But she's been silent since. Will Governor Brown remain silent and allow her staff to undermine wildlife, conservation, and constitutional checks and balances, or will she take a leadership role? During the push to delist, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife ignored a lengthy mandated review of its wolf plan. Since a 2012 settlement, Oregon's plan has been seen as a model around the country. With a focus on transparency, clarity, and enforceable standards, Oregon's wolf population grew while conflict decreased. Sadly, those provisions no longer apply. Conservation groups are weighing in and advocating for a continuation of successful policies. Anti-wolf interests are already pushing for hunting of wolves as soon as next year. Meanwhile, ODFW staff are asking for maximum discretion to make decisions as they see fit. The public has been getting mixed messages regarding their next steps. With a leadership vacuum, will Oregon's wolf plan continue to be the model for the rest of America, or will it devolve back into unnecessary conflict? Just this week, in the middle of the night, Greg Walden made false claims about Oregon's wolves to narrowly approve a proposal to strip them of federal protections. With wolves already federally delisted in most of eastern Oregon, the legislation targets the only wolf pack in Oregon Cascades, OR7's Rogue Pack, and the couple of individual wolves that have returned to southern Oregon. Walden's comment was attached to a bill the Senate has said that they will not consider. This is political theater at taxpayer expense, but Walden's proposal could become a rider on must-pass budget legislation. In Salem and Washington, D.C., wolves are being used as political bargaining chips. The good news, if there is any, is that Oregon's other representatives opposed Walden. Thank you to Peter DeFazio, Earl Blumenauer, Susanna Bonamici, and Kurt Schrader. State delisting was based in part on federal protections being in place. Will relentless congressional attacks on the Endangered Species Act result in OR7 and the Western Oregon wolves being subjected to the whims of politicians in Salem and Governor Brown's ODFW? Or will we allow them time to recover? While Oregon's wolf population has grown, the trend on the policy front is troubling. ODFW and politicians in Salem seem to be repeating rather than learning from past mistakes. Fortunately, it's becoming increasingly difficult to ignore the overwhelming majority of Oregonians who support conservation and who are showing up and speaking out. The answer to all the rhetorical questions posed here are very much in play, and they are very much in our hands. In the coming weeks and months, expect to hear how you can get involved and ensure wolf recovery stays on track for future generations of wolves and us. If you're looking for ways to get involved, you can join one of the Wild Ones activist groups in Portland, Bend, or Eugene. You can encourage friends to join this wolf pack mailing list or like Oregon's Wolves on Facebook. And you should stay tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz and Earth First Radio for more opportunities to get involved and make sure your voice is heard for Oregon's Wolves. For Wolves and Wildlife, this was written by Rob Clavens, Northeast Oregon Field Coordinator for Oregon Wild. And Sea Shepherd has launched a campaign to investigate the farmed salmon industry. Sea Shepherd Conservation Society has teamed with renowned Canadian biologist Alexandra Morton and actor-activist Pamela Anderson for Operation Virus Hunter, a new campaign investigating the lawfulness of the salmon farming industry of British Columbia. The announcement comes simultaneously as Sea Shepherd releases its latest public service announcement about the dangers of consuming farmed salmon. The PSA features Anderson, a British Columbia Canadian native, who is also the nonprofit organization's chairman of the board. Morton Anderson and Canada's premier environmentalist David Suzuki will be among those on hand to announce the campaign launch at a press conference at False Creek Harbor Authority. I guess this already happened on Monday, July 18th. Operation Virus Hunter, which begins in Vancouver, will see Morton travel aboard Sea Shepherd's research vessel Martin Sheen over the course of several weeks, tracing the major salmon migration route that stretches from mainland Vancouver to the north end of Vancouver Island. Along the route, the Martin Sheen will be stopping at various salmon farms to conduct audits for disease and other factors, which will be done in a non-aggressive and non-harassing manner. The salmon farming industry thrives on secrecy, shrouding its activities from public view, said Morton. Operation Virus Hunter will shine a bright spotlight on this industry. Canada cannot claim it is protecting the oceans, including wild salmon, while at the same time allowing the farm salmon industry to release waste into the world's largest salmon migration route. Added Anderson, salmon farms keep pens in the ocean, where the fish swim in their own feces and breed disease and sea lice that kill wild salmon, threatening the orca's ability to feed. In addition to Morton, Anderson, and Suzuki, Sea Shepherd Captain Una Lyol and First Nations leader Chief Ernie Cray will also be on hand at the July 18th conference. Let's hope they made it. 94 nations of the Fraser River view wild salmon as being essential to who they are, and they have worked to conserve these stocks for thousands of years, said Cray. The recent salmon declines are a threat to our existence, and we hold salmon farms to be one of the culprits. The Department of Fisheries and Oceans chooses foreign salmon farmers over our titles and rights again and again. We ask that wild salmon be allowed to come and go to this river free from infection with farmed salmon diseases. Sea Shepherd founder Paul Watson stated, "It is personally very satisfying to me to send one of our vessels to my home province of British Columbia to address one of the most insidious threats to biodiversity on the West Coast, salmon farms. Our mission is to investigate, document, and expose an industry that is spreading disease, parasites, and destroying the natural habitat of our wild salmon, the coho, sockeye, and the chinook. These exotic Atlantic salmon simply do not belong in these waters." And from the Earth First Newswire, why a federal court has ruled against the United States Navy in favor of whales in this story by Simone McCarty of the Christian Science Monitor, as found on the Earth First Newswire. A new court ruling has been issued in the ongoing conflict between the U.S. Navy and marine wildlife advocates. This time, the ruling has come down in favor of whales, dolphins, and other marine mammals that are adversely affected by the use of Navy sonar. Sonar, which involves navigation or detection of underwater objects using sound waves, is also a natural phenomenon used by whales and dolphins to locate prey or members of their pods. Yet the human-developed version of sonar can be harmful to marine mammals and their feeding and mating patterns. Friday's decision by the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in California found that a 2012 decision to allow the naval use of low-frequency sonar for training, testing, and operations was way out of step with language in the Marine Mammal Protection Act. That act says that peacetime oceanic programs must have, quote, "the least practicable adverse impact on marine mammals," unquote. Rules set in 2012 by the National Marine Fisheries Service permitted the U.S. Navy's sonar use to affect about 30 whale species and 24 pinnipeds, such as seals and sea lions, and required the Navy to shut down the sonar if the animals were near. The approval of use of this technology covered peacetime operations in the Pacific, Atlantic, and Indian Oceans and the Mediterranean Sea, according to Associated Press reports. The appellate panel explained that they felt that the Fisheries Service did not have adequate protection to areas of the world's oceans flagged by its own experts as biologically important, according to a summary released with the court's decision last Friday. This decision is in contrast to a 2008 Supreme Court ruling which reversed a California judge's restrictions on naval use of sonar. We do not discount the importance of plaintiffs' ecological, scientific, and recreational interests in marine mammals, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote for the majority at that time. Those interests, however, are plainly outweighed by the Navy's need to conduct realistic training exercises to ensure that it is able to neutralize the threat posed by enemy submarines. Last year, environmental groups led by the Natural Resources Defense Council, who opposed the sonar, received another victory when a federal judge in Honolulu signed an agreement banning or limiting mid-frequency active sonar and explosives in certain parts of Southern California and Hawaiian Island waters. That ruling included explosives training that the Navy at that time said had caused the death of 155 whales and dolphins in the area. Estimates for serious injuries were much higher, in the range of 2,000 in Hawaii and Southern California, the Christian Science Monitor reported last year. The use of sonar, which was subject to Friday's ruling, has been shown to cause whales to swim hundreds of miles, change depth with a pace that causes injury to them, or beach themselves in order to avoid what Scientific American calls rolling walls of noise that are nearly double the decibel level of the loudest rock concert. The Natural Resources Defense Council has been involved in lawsuits against the use of this technology as part of a larger campaign to limit man-made oceanic noises that affect the health, feeding, and breeding patterns for marine mammals. Other examples include sounds caused by shipping vessels and seismic and oil gas drilling. This late ruling, as well as last year's Honolulu decision, may suggest a greater emphasis on minimizing human impact on the habitat of sea mammals. And expanding farms harm nature on 58% of the world's land, a study has found in this story by Alistair Doyle of World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. An expansion of farmland has damaged nature beyond a safe limit of 58% of the world's land surface, threatening natural services such as crop pollination by insects, scientists said last Thursday. Grasslands such as in the United States, Argentina, South Africa, or Central Asia are among the natural systems most affected by declines in animals and plants caused by human activities, they wrote in the journal Science. Northern pine forests and tundra are the least affected, they said. Overall, the study said the diversity of animals and plants on 58% of the world's land area, home to 71% of all people, had fallen below a safe threshold, driven mainly by an expansion of farmland, as well as by roads and bigger cities. They defined safe as places where the local abundance of species was at least 90% of levels in comparable regions untouched by human activity. They based the conclusions on 2.38 million records for 39,123 species at 18,659 sites. The declines raise risks for natural services such as pollination of food crops by insects, production of nutrients by soils, and the ability of forests to absorb carbon dioxide as a natural brake on climate change. If we keep degrading biodiversity, there will be a point at which it's very difficult to support agriculture, lead author Tim Newbold of University College London told Reuters. Still, the study said there was uncertainty about the 90% threshold for damage. Some other scientists believe nature can withstand bigger declines. Given the stakes, it's best to be precautionary, said Newbold, who previously worked at the UN Environment Program. Intact natural systems are the most resilient to shocks such as droughts, floods, disease, or global warming. Decision makers worry a lot about economic recessions, but an ecological recession could have even worse consequences, Andy Purvis, another author of the study at the Natural History Museum of London, said in a statement. Until and unless we can bring biodiversity back up, we're playing ecological roulette, he added. The report complements work by a separate group of scientists seeking to outline planetary boundaries or safe limits for human prosperity in areas such as biodiversity, climate change, ocean acidification, and freshwater use. Sarah Cornell, who coordinates research into planetary boundaries at the Stockholm Resilience Center, welcomed Thursday's finding as a step to pin down links between biodiversity and ecosystems. Loss of the biodiversity means much more fragile systems, she said. And can we feed the world without cutting forests? It can be done, says the UN in this story by Magdalena Mies of World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Agriculture is the biggest driver of deforestation globally, fueled by a growing demand for food, yet it is possible to feed the world without cutting forests, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization said on Monday. Most forest loss occurs in the world's tropical regions, which lost 7 million hectares, about 15 million acres of forest a year between 2000 and 2010, while gaining 6 million hectares per year in agricultural land, FAO said in a report. Some countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America have managed to change this pattern by improving land rights, boosting agricultural production, and protecting forests, FAO said. There has always been the thinking that in order to produce more food to feed a growing population, you need to clear more land for agriculture, said Eva Mueller, Director of Forest Policy and Resources Division at FAO. But it is possible to produce more food without cutting forests, she told Thomson Reuters Foundation in an interview. The United Nations estimates that by 2015, the world will need to feed, the world will need to feed a population of more than 9 billion, up from 7.4 billion persons today. Yet 80% of arable land is already in use globally. Chile, Vietnam, Gambia, and Ghana were among more than 20 countries that in the past two decades improved their food security by increasing agricultural production while maintaining or increasing forest cover, FAO added. One of the key factors, Mueller said, was investment in agriculture to boost production. The investment in agriculture was mainly to increase agricultural productivity through intensification rather than in clearing new land or agriculture, she said. Better land planning and improved land rights, which contribute to better protection of forests and improved coordination between forest and agricultural policies, were also important, she said. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. and is broadcast at 9 p.m. You can hear a rebroadcast of this show at 3 p.m. on Free Radio Santa Cruz. And we would like to welcome KOWA 106.5 FM in Olympia, Washington, which will be broadcasting the Earth First Update on Saturdays at 7 a.m. And Grateful Dread Public Radio has changed their URL. You can now find them at gdreadradio.net. That is gdreadradio.net. And you can hear the Earth First Update there on Sundays at 2 a.m. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to ask you to please tune in to the Earth First Update next week. And if you can, ask your local public radio station to air the Earth First Update each week. It is free to download at radioforall.net.